Why are we looking at these rabbis specifically? We're looking at these rabbis specifically because they are living in an era where Judaism is fundamentally being reshaped. They are living in the wake of massive destruction and trying to figure out how to create a new world in which Judaism can take a form in which it will survive and potentially thrive. We're going to see over the next few weeks that the stories convey different sort of strategic choices by the rabbis, which seem to be influenced at least in part by their personalities as conveyed in the stories. Let's make one thing clear before we dive in. We are not going to be engaging here in the, can we read these stories to discover the historical kernel personality of whoever? That's not what we're doing. These are literary sort of retellings. What we are going to do is try to look for connective threads of how the rabbis are portrayed in the stories and understand them on those terms. Who are they within the stories? What can we garner about who they are, what they care about, the choices that they are making to shape Judaism as it will evolve for the next 2,000 years? And what can we, many of us who feel that we are living in an ever more uncertain world, learn about the sort of choices that we might make in a world where it feels like things are changing? We're going to start today with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We're diving in the middle of the Roman siege around Jerusalem. A little bit of background. The Roman siege around Jerusalem takes place in response to the Judean revolt, led at least in the rabbinic understanding by a group called the Sicarii, also known as the Zealots, or in this text, a very uncomplimentary name, the Birionim, which essentially means the thugs. We're looking right now at Jerusalem in particular. The Romans are stationed around Jerusalem in a siege. Jerusalem, theoretically, at least according to the rabbis, had enough food supplies to be able to withstand a siege of years. The Zealots, however, because they are trying to force a confrontation with the Romans, they still believe that maybe there is the possibility of actually defeating the Romans militarily, burn the food in the city, burn the food supplies, in order to try to force the people to engage with the Romans militarily because they have no choice out of starvation. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai will be the main character in our story today. He is thought to be representative of the rabbinic position, which is hoping for the possibility of some sort of diplomatic solution with the Romans. He understands that there cannot possibly be the hope of military victory over the Romans. But the rabbis have very little power because the thugs have essentially created their own siege within the Jerusalem walls. They're not allowing anyone to go out to engage with the Romans. We're going to jump in and see where the story goes from there. This text that we're studying today is from the Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. Interestingly, it's one of a series of texts about the destruction of Jerusalem that appears in Tractate Gittin, the Masechet, the tractate that deals primarily with divorce. An interesting sort of metaphor if you think of the destruction of the temple as a sort of fracturing of the Jewish relationship with God. Let's dive in. Abba Sikra, the head of the thugs of Jerusalem, was a son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's sister. Let's pause for a moment because we've just gotten information that is both very important in order to understand the cast of characters, but also to understand just how deeply intertwined all of these groups in Jerusalem are. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is, in fact, the uncle of Abba Sikra, the head of the thugs. That means that he has a familial relationship that he can draw on, even though these two groups, the rabbis and the thugs, the zealots, the sicarii, whatever you want to call them, are enemies at the time. That's going to be important for the first part of the story. But on a thematic level, I think what's so important here is the author of this story is beginning by telling us, sure, there are these different groups, and they are so actually closely twined together, right? You're a zealot. You're a sicari. That means that you want to go to war with the Romans. You're a rabbi. That means that you want to make peace with the Romans. You would think that these are two opposite groups, and yet they are, in fact, deeply enmeshed. They are family. They are friends. They are neighbors. The author is turning your attention to the fact that this is, as much as it is a war against the Romans, also a civil war. And civil wars come with that deep fracturing of society, of civil fabric, of families. Let's keep going. Rabbi Yochanan sent him a message, come privately to me. He came. Rabbi Yochanan said to him, until when will you do this and kill the world with famine? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is looking at him and saying, you're burning the food stores. You are killing people. There is widespread destruction in Jerusalem already without the Romans doing a thing. Just for background as to how bad the famine gets, we have all sorts of different texts that are often read on Tisha B'Av, describing the horrors of the destruction of the temple. Many of the most horrific and evocative are actually those that describe the hunger and the famine of the time, rather than anything the Romans did. And let's remember, that's something that is actually internally caused. That's something that Jews within Jerusalem do to other Jews and also to themselves. He said to him, meaning Abba Sikari, the head of the zealots, says back to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, what should I do? Since if I say anything to them, they will kill me. Meaning he's looking at Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and saying, I actually cannot do anything at this moment. I am ostensibly the head of this movement. But if I tell them we have to stop, or if I tell them stop burning the food, or if I tell them let's make peace with the Romans or surrender to the Romans, they're just going to kill me and presumably choose someone else who will do the same thing. I want us to pay attention here. This is going to be a story about a lot of people who feel stuck. A lot of people who feel that they actually do not have any decision-making power, that they can do no other than what they are already doing. And the bravery of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is going to come in trying within what seems like a totally choiceless scenario, finding little points of choice that might make a difference. Let's keep going. He said to him, show me a solution for me that I should get out. Maybe there will be a small salvation from it. Okay, I'm going to ask people to pay attention now, and you can answer in the chat. A small salvation. In the Aramaic, it's tzahala porta. What's interesting about that phrase, a small salvation? Salvation is a word that conveys miracles, that conveys our problems are going to be solved, we're going to come out of this to a happy ending. A small salvation is different. A small salvation is already saying, I see where we are, and there is not going to be a big, miraculous, happy ending here. We're looking for something different. We are looking for something, I might actually say, very non-biblical, right? There is no big, splashy, biblical miracle that will be happening here. But we may find a way towards a small, very human sort of salvation. a salvation that may not save Jerusalem, may even not save the city, but may be enough to give Judaism the spark that it needs to continue. Let's keep going. He said to him, meaning Abba Sikra, the head of the zealots, says back to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, act as if you are sick and have everyone come and ask about you. And then bring something putrid and have it lay with you, and they will say that you died. And have your students bring you out, and no other men should bring you out, so that we don't become aware that you are light, since they know that a living person is lighter than a dead one. Let's make sure we understand what's going on here. Abba Sikra is essentially saying, fake your own death. Now, why will faking his own death help him? Because the zealots have posted guards in the city such that they will not let anyone go out. But the zealots, even though they seem to have no respect for life, have still a respect for the sanctity of Jerusalem. And there is a law in Jewish tradition that a dead body may not remain in Jerusalem overnight. If Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai fakes his own death, they will have a way to smuggle him out of the city because the zealots will allow him to be carried out of the city, presumably to be buried outside. He did this. Rabbi Eliezer went on one side and Rabbi Yoshua went in on the other side, meaning those two men are each carrying his body. That will be important later on. These are two main students of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who we will see feature in future weeks. When they came to the opening, the thug gatekeepers wanted to stab him, meaning they understand that some people might be using this as a tactic to smuggle people out of the city. And they're essentially saying, okay, we'll stab him so that if he wasn't dead already, he'll certainly be dead after that. They said to them, the Romans will say they stabbed their rabbi. Let's just pay attention here because I think part of what the author of the story is doing here is not only showing us how does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai make the decisions that he makes given the situation with the Romans, but also what has become of Jerusalem and of the Judaism that is soon to be destroyed here. Where are we at this moment? We are looking at a Jerusalem that is filled with people who are willing to burn food, force people into famine, but not to let a dead body remain in Jerusalem overnight because they won't allow Jerusalem to be contaminated. These are people who would stab a body going out of Jerusalem, presumably killing anyone who would be sort of trying to pretend to get out. They have no fear of bloodshed. But the reasoning, well, the Romans will hear and the Romans will say you're disrespectful, that matters to them. There's been such a breakdown of priorities that we're looking at a Jerusalem that can no longer appreciate that life matters more than sanctity, or that life matters more than what the Romans will think of the Jews. And then they wanted to jostle him. And on line 13, they said to them, they will say they jostled their rabbi. They opened the gate, he went out. Okay, this is part one of the story. I want us to pay attention here. The being smuggled out, pretending to be a dead body is, of course, within the logic of the story, a very clever tactic. But what's going on here symbolically, right? What we have here is what looks like a dead body being carried out of Jerusalem. And then once it leaves the gates of Jerusalem, he stands up tall and he's actually alive. By the way, there is a very famous story, very famous in the Western world, about an important resurrection that takes place around the same time and around in the same place. There is a reason for that, right? The early Christians and the rabbis are actually living in the same cultural reality. and both have experienced destruction and the beginning of rebirth, it makes sense that they're both drawing on these sort of symbols. He got there and said, "Peace to you, O King, peace to you, O King." All right, let's make sure we understand what's going on. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai has left the city. Standing outside of the city is the Roman army. At the head of the Roman army at this point is Vespasian, who is currently a general. As we'll see, he'll soon find out that he has recently been named emperor, but he does not know that yet. Let's go back. "Peace to you, O King, peace to you, O King." Vespasian said to him, "You have made yourself guilty of two death penalties. First, since I am not a king and you have called me king. And also, if I am a king, why did you not come to me until now?" One of the interesting things about rabbinic stories is that they don't tell you either what people are thinking or tone of voice. You have to kind of intuit it, right? There's something about that. If I'm a king, why have you not come to me until now? That you can imagine, I can't do this accent, but you can imagine sort of in the tone and accent of a Jewish man on the Lower East Side in kind of the 50s, right? If I'm a king, why have you not come to me until now? It seems that maybe he's engaged, he's curious, he maybe is a little bit, yes, Deborah says, possibly admiring the cleverness and the bravery. I think that might be at play here. He said to him, meaning Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said back to him, "That which you said, I am not a king, you will be a king. Since were you not a king, Jerusalem would not be delivered into your hands. As it is written, and the Levanon will fall by a mighty one. And mighty can only be a king, as it is written, and his mighty ones shall be from him. And Levanon can only be the temple, as it is stated, this goodly mountain and the Levanon." Okay. I want us to note two things here. The first is Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is engaging in very classic rabbinic play here, right? This is very midrashic. He's playing on verses and linking one to the other. But the second thing I want us to notice is that if you don't know the end of this story, if you're a first-time reader, the words, "You will be a king, since were you not a king, Jerusalem would not be delivered into your hand," should hit you like a punch in the gut. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai has already prepared us for this a little. He said a small salvation. He's telling Vespasian, I'm not deluded. I know that you are going to conquer Jerusalem. It's obvious to me. We're both mature men. Let's tell the truth about this. And we, as the reader, should have just felt whatever last vestige of hope we might have had for Jerusalem fall away. I want us to note two other things. The first thing I want us to note is this verse that he uses, where he talks about Levanon as Jerusalem, this goodly mountain and the Levanon. That's actually from Moshe's last plea to God to allow him to cross into Israel. We know that that plea is going to be denied, but I want us really to appreciate what the author is doing here. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai has just left Jerusalem for the last time. His back is to Jerusalem. He is facing the Roman legion, which he knows will conquer it. And he is evoking the words of Moshe, who desperately longed to be able to see Jerusalem just once, to be able to see the land of Israel just once. And I think that is a message for us, the reader. Vespasian can't understand it. Vespasian has only heard, well, you're going to be a king, and I know Jerusalem's going to fall to your hand. But we, the reader, hear through it Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's grief. He is grieving here. He is grieving the Jerusalem that he is leaving behind. He is grieving the Jerusalem in the world that he knows is about to be lost. The second thing I want us to notice here is this line from Jeremiah, from Yirmiyahu, and his mighty one shall be from him. We're not going to look inside for the sake of time, but that is indeed in the context of a prophecy of destruction about Jerusalem. But immediately after that, in the verses in Yirmiyahu, in Jeremiah, is a prophecy about the eventual Messiah and salvation and the eventual rebuilding of Jerusalem. Why does that matter? That matters because there are two layers of messaging going on here. There's the messaging of what will Vespasian understand? What Vespasian understands is you will be king and you will destroy Jerusalem. But within that, what is the encoded message to us, to the readers, to the future? Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying, yes, Jerusalem will be destroyed. That has been prophesied. But immediately after that, we also know that there is a prophecy that Jerusalem will be rebuilt. Even in this moment of surrender, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is encoding a message of hope, of possibility for the future. And that which you said, if I'm a king, why did you not come to me until now? The thugs that we have with us did not allow us. Okay, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai just did something incredibly clever. The thugs that we have with us would not allow us. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is doing something incredibly clever here. He first of all is making sure that Vespasian understands not everyone in Jerusalem is part of this group that has made war on you, right? There are zealots, there are thugs, but they're not everyone. And he has claimed for himself the majority. The thugs that we have with us, he's essentially saying they are a small, violent group that has seized control, but we, the majority, we are not them. We are different. He's essentially asking Vespasian, think of the Jews not as a single entity that is the enemy of Rome, but to see the way that he, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, sees, which is a fractured society, most of which does not want what those who have seized control are currently doing. Vespasian understands this. He said to him, if there is a barrel of honey with a serpent wrapped over it, would one not break the barrel for the sake of getting the serpent? Let's just take the metaphor here. In the metaphor, the zealots would be the serpent wrapped around the barrel of honey. The barrel of honey is presumably Jerusalem. And Vespasian's saying, yeah, I understand that it's not all of you. But what you have right now is a serpent that is wrapped around your people. My job is to get rid of the serpent, and sometimes that means that you're gonna have to break the barrel. Vespasian is essentially, I think, saying to Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, I understand that, and it's also too late. Vespasian is almost echoing the words of Abba Sikra here. I have no choice. What do you expect me to do? Again, this is a story of many men, many leaders who it feels like are on an unstoppable trajectory. What can we do given the choices that have already been made? Most of them feel like there is nothing they can do. There is no way to change it. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is looking for the tiny, tiny levers, the small points where choice still exists that might allow us to change the future. He was silent, meaning Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai does not say anything back. Rav Yosef, and some say Rabbi Akiva, would read this verse to be about this. He turns back the wise and renders their knowledge foolish. He should have said to him, we take tongs and we take the serpent and kill him and leave the barrel. This is an interjection by future rabbis, either Rav Yosef or Rabbi Akiva, who are looking at this story and saying, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai made the wrong choice. Here's an answer you could have given. You could have said, we take tongs and we remove the serpent from around the barrel. You don't have to break the barrel. I want us to pay attention to two things about this. First of all, what this is pointing out is, I think, presumably Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is actually making a choice here. Right? Rabbi Akiva, hundreds of years later, is not thinking of something, presumably, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai simply didn't think of in the moment. I think one way to read this is not that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai can't think of an answer, but that part of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai may also know that Jerusalem is too far gone. What happens when you have a Jerusalem where people value sanctity and impurity more than they value human life? What happens when you have a society in which people are willing to starve all of their neighbors in order to achieve their political ends? One reading here might be Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai actually knows that on some level, Jerusalem is already destroyed. And part of what he's trying to do here is move forward and build something else. I want us to pay attention to the rabbi who interjects here. The rabbi who interjects here, at least in one tradition, is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is living around 70 to 100 years after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai here is making a grand gamble. He is gambling that there is some way, if he plays his cards right and he plays his cards carefully, to allow Judaism to continue to exist, to change into something else, even without Jerusalem, even without the temple. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai will die not knowing if he succeeded. Rabbi Akiva, around 70 years later, is living at the height of Roman persecution of the rabbis and of Judaism writ large. Rabbi Akiva himself dies as a martyr executed by the Romans for teaching Torah. And what Rabbi Akiva might be saying when he says, you should have answered this, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he might be saying, I'm standing at my point in history 70 years later, and it looks to me like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's gamble lost. He was wrong. Torah is being stamped out. The rabbis are being executed. It looks like the Romans want to stamp out Judaism altogether. There are two other layers of time, though, here in this story. The narrator who puts together this story presumably lives in Babylonia, approximately 500 years after the story takes place. The narrator who puts together this story the way that we have it knows that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's gamble has paid off. There are massive, massive centers of Judaism and Torah thriving both at this time in the land of Israel and in the land of Babylonia. He sees that there is a Judaism that can indeed live without the temple, without the Beit HaMikdash, without Jerusalem. And we too, as readers, are levels in that kind of historical reevaluation of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's grand gamble. We are living 2,000 years later, and we know that what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gambled to create not only created a Jerusalem that could thrive in the absence of the temple, in the absence of Jerusalem, but carry us through to a day when Jews would one day live in Jerusalem again. We're the recipients of that gamble. We are those who have lived to see the gamble succeed. Let's keep going in the story. By and by, a messenger came to him from Rome, meaning came to Vespasian. He said to him, get up, the reigning Caesar has died, and those dignitaries of Rome have placed you at the helm. Ta-da! Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's prediction was true. Vespasian is king. He has to go, and he has to take over as emperor. He had put on one of his shoes and wanted to put the other one on. It would not go on. He tried to remove the first one. It would not come off. He said, "What is this?" He said to him, "Do not be troubled. It is a good tiding that has come to you. As it is written, a good tiding fattens the bone." Vespasian said to him, "But what is the remedy?" Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai responded, "Bring someone who is hard for you to take and have him pass in front of you, as it is written, and a lowly spirit dries the bone." He did this, and the other shoe went on. We're going to really not spend a lot of time on the shoe metaphor for right now for the sake of time, but I want us to note two things. One, this story is, actually, we'll only focus on one for a moment. This theme of taking off shoes and of putting on shoes again, going shoeless is, in at least some rabbinic traditions, a sign of mourning. Vespasian is obviously not mourning, but we, the reader who knows that Jerusalem is about to be destroyed, we are picking up on that symbol. We are picking up on that symbol of mourning. The other is that presumably Vespasian keeps getting more and more impressed with Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. The guy understood, the guy predicted that I am going to be emperor. He is solving my local problem here with I'm rushing to get back to Rome and my shoes won't come on. He has wisdom that Vespasian presumably, it seems, can respect. And why does that matter? It matters because part of what is happening here, and I think part of the hope that the narrator is putting into this story, is what happens when you, instead of having two sort of faceless masses, you have the Romans, you have the Jews, what happens when you take two individuals and have them have a conversation, right? What happens when you have two men standing in front of each other, having a conversation? Can there be change that comes out of that, even if each of them is bound to their role? Vespasian knows what he has to do. Vespasian cannot allow Jerusalem to escape. But can there still be, within that conversation between two human beings, the possibility of something different? He said to him, "And since you are so wise, until now, why did you not come to me?" This is Vespasian speaking to Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. I want us to notice this is actually a repetition of what Vespasian said to him at the beginning, right? Vespasian said to him at the beginning, "If I'm a king, why have you not come to me until now?" And we said in that phrasing, there was maybe something of a threat, maybe something of amusement, maybe something of surprise. But I think at this moment in the repetition, really more than anything, there's sorrow, right? Let's read this again. "And since you are so wise, why did you not come to me until now?" I think there's something here in Vespasian that's grieving, that's saying, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, if we had met earlier, two people like you and me, two men like you and me, before things went so far, before things began to be inevitable, what could two men like you and me have done? Perhaps we could have changed things. He said to him, "Didn't I already tell you?" He replied to him, "I also already told you." Meaning, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying, "I already told you I couldn't come to you until now because of the zealots." And Vespasian, I think, is replying, "And I already told you, by now it's too late. I have no choice except to destroy Jerusalem in order to get rid of the zealots." Again, this place of where we've come to a place that feels hopeless. We've come to a place that feels choiceless. What would have happened if we had had this conversation earlier? And now that it is this late, and it is now that we are having this conversation, what small choices might remain for us? He said to him, "I'm leaving and I will send someone else, but ask something that I can give you." Vespasian is saying a lot in very few words here. First of all, he's making sure that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai knows this isn't over. "I'm leaving, but I'm going to send someone else. There will be another general here. This train is going to keep going on the same tracks." but ask me something that I can give you. He's telling him very carefully right now, even I, even the emperor, still have very, very circumscribed choices. Ask me something achievable. You can't ask for Jerusalem. That's not going to be possible. But ask me something that I actually can give to you. He said to him, give me Yavne and her sages and the line of Rabban Gamliel and a cure to heal Rabbi Tzadok. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is asking for the salvation of a few. But within that salvation of a few, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is making very careful choices. First of all, Yavne and her sages, the Judaism that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is about to create is going to be a Judaism that is centered not around the temple, but around Torah. Who does he want to save here? He wants to save those who he believes the sages can be the foundation of this new Judaism, a Judaism that will look to law rather than to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple. Rabban Gamliel. Who's Rabban Gamliel? Rabban Gamliel is the son of the Nasi, the political head of the Jewish people. That matters for two reasons. First of all, that matters because Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is thinking about what's the infrastructure we need, who are the people we need. We are still going to need to have some sort of political entity. We are not going to be merely a religion. We are still going to be a people. And for that, we need to save this line of the political sort of hereditary. But the second is that the house of the Nasi are said to be descendants of King David. Why does that matter? It matters because Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is always looking towards the future. Descendants of King David, why does that matter? It matters because every prophecy we have tells us that one day the Messiah will come from King David. One day the Mashiach will come from King David, from his line. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, even in this moment that feels like total surrender, is planning for the future. Rabbi Tzadok, the last one he asks for, he's a Kohen. He's a priest. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is making sure, again, one day, presumably, the temple will be rebuilt, however far in the future. And he's saying on that day, we will need priests. In this ask are all the seeds of hope for what might one day be. Rabbi Yosef, and some say Rabbi Akiva, would read this verse to be about this. He turns back the wise and renders their knowledge foolish. He should have said to him, leave us this time. And he thought that perhaps that much he would not do. And then there would not even be a small salvation. Why does Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai not ask for that, not say go away? Because Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, from the beginning, the narrator is telling us, has understood what we're looking at. We're looking at a world of limited choice. We're looking at a world where it seems Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is actually the only leader who looks at this situation and says, let's see what could be different. He's looking for the small points of choice, the small levers that he can push and change the world. Jerusalem is not a small lever. He knows that that won't be granted to him. But with those small levers, he's making a gamble about what the future can be, and that we, as his inheritors 2,000 years later, indeed knows is a future that is, I think, more vibrant, more successful, more miraculous than Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai ever could have imagined. We have 1 minute to go, so this is where I want to leave us. Over the next few weeks, we are going to be studying different stories of the various rabbis who are living in the wake of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's choice. And we'll be looking at them through the lens of them as inheritors of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's grand gamble. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai saying, give me Yavne and her sages rather than give me Jerusalem, is making a gamble. He's making a gamble about what Judaism might be, what it could be. What we're going to look at over the next few weeks are the inheritors of that gamble. What are the choices that they make? And what are the hopes that they have for the Judaism of the future in making those choices?